This is Beers on Us with Patrick Harris, a podcast that dives deep into the craft beer scene here in the greater metropolitan Portland area. A podcast that is meant to inform, educate, and have friendly discussion about the thing we love most. Thank you so much for downloading this podcast. Please rate, review, subscribe, and all that fun stuff as it helps continue this podcast's success. Thank you for listening. Welcome back into Beers on Us with Patrick Harris. Thank you so much for joining us as we try to drop this every single Thursday at 4 p.m. If you didn't catch last week, we had Brian Cook from Lombard House on talking about anniversaries, state of the industry, a little fresh hop chat and stuff. Make sure you check that out. Brian was great, as he always is. You can download it wherever you get your podcasts. The Odyssey app, tannyofthefan.com, Twitcher, Stitcher, Omni, Apple Podcasts, Google Play. Mike always does this. I have no idea. Just go download and do the fun stuff. Today's going to be a fun episode. I'm very pleased to be joined by a stalwart of this industry, an old friend of mine, Sean Burke, in the house. Your reputation speaks for itself. We'll get into all that kind of stuff. But thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me, man.
Fun story. I grabbed a couple beers and I said, Sean, what do you want to drink? And he chose this one. We were going to drink and sip and chat on Block 15's Blocktoberfest.
Yeah.
How do you feel about the Märzen Fest beer style?
I generally, with Märzen, I tend to find them more malty than I would prefer.
Mm-hmm.
So I like what a lot of the brewers are doing with more of the Fest beer, where it's getting a little lighter, maybe a little bit more hop pronounced. And so it's, I don't know, it's perfect beer for this time of year. So
yeah, it's one of those things. It's one of those things like Märzen Fest, Vienna, you know, they all live in this kind of weird bubble. There's something about the Vienna malt, just period, that talks to my soul.
Sure.
So however you use it, I think I have said this multiple times, you can make a bad Vienna lager and I'm like, I'll have that.
That's great.
Because I just love that crackery, toasty, biscuity malt character to it. But I'm with you, and I was chatting with, I was talking with Brian about it last week, that I think one thing that's really cool this year that I've seen better than other years is it's fresh hop season, and it is clearly fest beer season right now. I don't know if you've seen that on shelves.
Oh, yeah, 100%. No, we actually made a beer, fest beer, and it disappeared just instantly, which for, you know, multi lager, that's not been the case in a lot of, you know, it trickles out, but yeah, it's everywhere on the shelves, and apparently people are loving it, so that's a good thing. So.
Yeah, it makes me kind of think, and I don't know, maybe we'll transition just right into that, into fresh hop season. It makes me think that, you know, a lot of us kind of chat, and as you work in the beer industry for a long time, fresh hop gets a little stale.
Yep.
For some people. It becomes kind of an arduous task, and it's not very profitable, and it is a lot of work, whether you're hot side or cold side, it's still a lot of work. But this year, I have seen the demand for fresh hop almost seem to wane a little bit, or maybe go flatline.
I think that's a good assessment. I think there's a lot of them out there. I think, you know, there's kind of customer fatigue too, and I mean, I think you're going to find that with any type of beer. But I think at some point, people are like, okay, well, I've had the fresh hop beers, and I've had the good ones, and you know, and it's yeah, from a brewer's point of view, I'm the wrong person to ask because. They severely screw up our schedule because you never know when they're going to be ready. I don't really love them. Mm-hmm. There are great ones out there, but just as a general type of beer, it's not. I don't get to this time of year and just, oh, this is the
here
best.
We go.
You know, exactly.
Did you make one this year?
Me too, actually. So we did a fresh hop Strata IPA.
Okay,
That was really nice. Got the hops off of Goshi Farms, and then we did a.
I think everybody got their Strata from Goshi
this year. Exactly, and it's kind of, you know, it's. They're great hops, and, and we've worked with a couple different growers in the past, but this year we decided to kind of work with them, and then we also did a version of our Landform pills with fresh U.S. Tets from there.
So, oh, okay, so cool.
It's great. It's one of those that, like, I think it's my favorite of the two.
Okay,
but it's mostly because it doesn't have a ton of fresh hop character, so it just tastes like a good pilsner.
Are you a hot side or a cold side guy?
So we did. Both on different beers. So on the Strata one, we did that cold side, and then the pills we did hot side.
So you find it based on the style is how you're going, as opposed to process.
Yeah. And I don't have a lot to go off of that because it's not really been my wheelhouse over the years. So I've done all sorts of stuff. I mean, my former employer, we did fresh hot beers in the cool ship, and that was kind of fun because it's just a great vessel for
it. Yeah, why not?
So, that was hot side, you know, so basically treating it like a hot back.
Mm-hmm.
But but you can get a lot more than you can get in a lot of hotbacks. So,
sure.
So that was kind of cool. So I don't know. I don't, there are people out there way smarter and way more into this than me. So
I don't want to waste too much time talking about Fresh Hop, but it is the season. And this might be the last Fresh Hop conversation I have on this pod, as we are in almost October. Is there any future in Fresh Hop? Do you think we'll get to a point where there's some new innovation, or is it just tweaking technique and seeing where the market goes?
I think it's coming. I definitely think it's coming. I mean, I think there are people doing it. I mean, I think what some of the stuff Breakside's done with Fresh Hop beers, and it shows, you know, their beers really stand out, and just, you know, processes and techniques to kind of deal with them. I think you're starting to see a lot more into the realm of fresh kilned.
Mm.
And I think that generally those are the ones that I prefer a little bit more, but,
you're losing some of that, like, vegetal, off the vine kind of character.
Which is really the thing that's not really all that attractive to me in the first
place. It's funny. I feel like it's not attractive to any of us, but the general consumer really likes it. The first year we did this podcast, Mike, we had ex novo Elliot, because, Ryan used to always be first.
Totally. Yep.
Which is classic Ryan. I remember tasting one and just being like, I get a hint of watermelon, and oh my God, I'm like chewing on marijuana.
That's exactly.
And Mike was like, this is awesome.
Yeah, exactly.
I was like, okay, man, this is not what we like here.
Totally. Combos generally not found in nature. I think there's a lot of room for it. And I think that there's a lot of, I mean, I think you've seen just in the world of pelletizing of the hops, you know, there's been a lot of progression as far as the way that those are treated. So I think that really that kind of thinking will eventually trickle down into fresh hop beers. But who knows? I mean, it's so much of it has to be driven by the consumer. And,
sure.
And I think to your point earlier, I think you're starting to see just a little bit of a taper off.
Mm-hmm.
And also with fest beers really kind of being out at the same time, maybe there's a little bit of competition.
Well, that lager train keeps rising and rising and rising. I'll finish up with this. Do you think the advancement and the innovation of cryo YCH, CGX Crosby, that kind of stuff can eventually kind of maybe taper off this idea of fresh off the vine hop?
I would love it if it would, but that's just a personal, you know what I mean?
It's got to be cheaper, right?
It is. And
CGX
that's
and cryo is way cheaper.
Totally.
Than
it absolutely is. And I mean, you know, generally those beers are made a lot of times with those products as well, you know, because if it's just fresh hop, it's pretty undrinkable at that point.
Yeah.
So. Well, not 100%, but, you know.
I know. I always feel bad for the hot side fresh hop people, because by the time their fresh hop IPAs come out, you've, like, got so much fatigue.
That's exactly.
That you're just like, I don't even want to try that. And someone's like, it's the best. And you, like, taste and you're like, yeah, it's good. I'll have the fest beer, please.
Yeah, it's exactly. Totally. I know. I'll get one or two in me. And then, I had one at Lombard House, actually, very recently. It was a Von Ebert beer. It was their fresh hop pills. And it was great. I mean, like, but again, it was just like subtle-handed, and I'm like, it's just a good pilsner.
There you go.
But I'll have something else now.
Sean Burke joining us here on Beers on Us. I want to like take you back, and we don't have to go too history, like open up the vault sort of thing. But we were chatting on the way into the studio that you used to homebrew with Ben and Rick over at Barrelick.
Yeah, absolutely.
Big friends of our show.
Yeah. Great.
So as you're in that homebrew community, How were you able to take the step into being more of a professional brewer? Is Commons your first professional brewing gig?
It was.
Yeah. How do you, as a home brewer, and you've made some friends, and obviously Ben and Rick have been very successful in their endeavor, you as well. Mm-hmm. How do you make that jump from home brewing into professional brewing?
Well, I kind of, so to kind of talk about the home brewing side that we did together, we actually had a barrel project thing that we would work on. So multiple home brewers would get together and contribute wort and or beer and have a barrel at somebody's house and do mixed culture beer that way, just because, you know, volume wise that was the best way we could do it, but it also built this nice little community for us. So after, you know, that's, and at that point I had been homebrewing for years and years and years, and kind of all of us were at that level of and it's kind of why we put that group together,
because
it was like-minded people that Walker from Imperial Yeast was part of that group as well, you know, so really, really good group of people. But for me, I tried really hard to get into the industry at that time in Portland, and it just was, you know, you were basically left with washing kegs and that kind of stuff. And I was in my early 30s at that point.
Yeah.
And I was just like, I don't know, like, I'm not above that. I just don't.
Right.
I feel like I have more to contribute than just that, right? So I actually went over to
Brewing
School.
Also, the pay is really rough.
Yeah, it's totally. I mean, pay is really rough in general. But, But I went to brewing school instead, okay. So I figured I would just cut in line, and it worked.
Yeah.
And so one of the guys from that group was at the time working at Cascade, and I reached out to him when I was still in Germany and said, hey, I'm coming home in a couple months. Know anybody that's hiring? He said, yeah, get in touch with Mike Wright. He's going to expand what was at the time Becher Brewing, which was his little nano in his garage. And so the next day after landing back in Portland, I went down to what was the original common space and met him and in person. And because we've been talking since then online mm-hmm. and stuff. So I cut in line a little bit, but at the same time, you know, I had to kind of teach myself. Like,
yeah.
I never really went and worked for anybody else except for, I mean, meaning that bringing in experience wasn't, you know, my experience was so different. It's more in the recipe development and that kind of stuff, not mm-hmm. in like, oh, this is safety and SOP. And, you know, you learn some of that in brewing school, but it's not the same.
Right.
You know, it's more theory based.
Okay, I get it. Like music. Like you can learn theory as much as you want, but if your hands can't do it,
that's exactly,
you know, if your vocal cords can't do it.
Or until you play in a band.
Right.
You know what I mean? You can sit there and jam out in your room all you want.
Plays well with others.
Exactly. Yeah, and that's kind of how it works. So, yeah.
So tell me about your time at Commons. I remember the old spot. God, I miss the old spot. Although the last spot is a really cool spot too. But I remember I had just moved back to Portland. This is probably 2013, maybe early 2014. And I was with my partner, and she had a work friend who had a partner as well, and we went to double date.
Nice.
They were like, oh, your boyfriend loves beer. And I was like, yeah, I love beer. And she was like, oh, we live right by these three breweries. Cool. And I was like, sweet, let's go check them out. And they took me to Commons, Cascade, and Groundbreaker.
Yeah.
And I, at the time, only drank IPA. That's all I drank. I didn't know any better. I was like, this is what I drink, or I drink Rainier and Busch Light.
Sure,
like,
sure.
This is it. This is all I know. And I walked into Commons, and boy, was I disappointed. I looked around, and I kind of said, I don't want any of this stuff. This stuff sounds terrible to me.
Yep.
But then flash forward a few years, I am very fortunate to be invited to the last night at Commons.
Yeah.
And I'm sitting there going, I can't believe I'm never going to have this beer again. Tell me about your time at Commons and what it taught you to help propel you to the Von Eberts, the Four Lands,
yeah,
et cetera.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, it's kind of, you know, what I was saying before, really having to sort of, in the beginning, I had to, just me, mm-hmm. doing most of the brewing, and you know, I was employee number one. So, well, in the beginning, it was a lot of construction.
Mm-hmm.
But it was great because, you know, I have enough sort of hands-on building, woodworking background that I was able to bring that to table. But really, it taught me a lot about a lot of things. You know, that's a very broad statement, but what I mean by that is not only in the beer front. You know, I felt like good beer wasn't the hard part, and I don't mean that to sound arrogant. I mean that to say that, you know, I feel like if you have a well enough developed palate,
mm-hmm.
you can eventually, if you've been doing it long enough, and I know home brewing's a whole other ball game, but if you've been doing it long enough, you kind of get to good beer pretty quickly.
Sure, sure.
And it's not to say that there's always room for improvement, but it's that all the other things. So there's, you know, customer service, there's brand building, mm-hmm. there's employee, you know, dealing with employees. And
I mean, think about how many breweries are making 50,000 barrels or more. And the beer's not very good.
That's exactly.
And think about how many people are making 2,000 barrels,
yep.
and nobody knows about them.
That's exactly.
Like I tell somebody, hey, have you ever had Alex's beer at Upright? And they're like, who? What?
Yep,
Gesundheit?
Exactly.
And I'm like, Upright. Yeah. It's maybe one of the best breweries on the West Coast. And they're like, nope, never been there. And you're like, okay, all right.
Still the most underrated brewery.
Okay, got it.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, I think that so much of that has to do with, you know, size can be in your advantage for quality a lot of times, mm-hmm. because you can have lab work, you can have all that kind of stuff, which is great. But, you know, I also feel like just generally having people that care about what's coming out,
mm-hmm.
know what good and bad is. And, you know, that's a relative term, but I mean.
I mean, I always say there's two kinds of beer, good beer and bad beer.
That's yeah, exactly. But a lot of that is in the eye of the beholder. You
sure.
know? So I think, but generally, it's recognized what good beer is. So. That being said, a lot of what I kind of took from it was, well, I mean, I had a lot of creative freedom, which was really, really awesome. And
hard to find sometimes
these days. Yeah, yeah. And I think one thing that I really, really, really miss as I'm kind of looking back on it is we were able to be a focused brewery, which I feel something we're really starting to lose in you know, kind of modern craft beer.
I feel like people call it niche, and that has exactly such a negative connotation.
Yeah, and it's, and I mean, but you travel anywhere in Europe, and it's, you know, you go to Cantillon to get a certain type of beer.
Right.
Like, you go to Pilsner or Kettle.
Focus.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it's, I mean, I understand that only making one type of beer could also have its negativity. And it's a very American thing to, you know.
Well, Yingling's the biggest brewery in America, and they make, what, three beers?
Three beers, yeah. It's exactly it. You know, I always say, like, what is that? Trumer Pills, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
They make one beer. But it's not that, you know, we were able to kind of have our lanes, I guess, is a good way of saying it. And, you know, in hindsight, we probably should have branched out sooner, but, you know, as the industry was sort of changing. But we were really on the tail end when you could do that, and I think that became a huge part of the draw for that place. So that was really, it was nice to see that kind of, and really hone your skills, because you're actually focusing in a couple of areas versus trying to paint this huge broad stroke, and then at the end you're just kind of like, well, I'm pretty good at most of this, you know, versus I'm a lot better at this little small area.
There might be like other factors that play into this, business, marketing, et cetera, but from a beer standpoint, do you think Commons would have more success in today's world? Or was it in its right spot?
I don't know. I really don't know. I think had we been more willing to attempt other beers, it's not that we weren't really willing. We just wanted to be good at what we did.
Yeah.
You know? We're always sort of touted as like, you're never going to make an IPA. Like, none of us said that.
Right.
So towards the end, like, especially having, you know, two brewers that were on staff that were really passionate about making IPA, it was like, well, yeah, we should have really just had those guys kind of run with it. So yes, I think that had that been the case, had we really kind of adjusted a little bit more, I think it would have been a lot more viable. But I mean, part of the demise was also just part of the landscape at the time too. Mm-hmm. You know, as it's changing, Portland was changing rapidly,
right,
and a lot of things. So it's, and you know, there's a lot to the buying the building and renovating it, and everything was a big thing to bite off, and
sure,
you know, it's, and it was all on Mike, and that's tough for him.
That is like, tough.
That's, yeah. But so really, to kind of get back to finally answering your question, I think there's just a maturity that happened to me over that time, where you know, I'd never really been a boss or anything like that, and you know, I learned how to do things a lot better than I did, you know. Not that it was terrible, I just I learned to be a better leader, I
there
suppose.
You go.
And I think one of the biggest things too was employing people that were better brewers than I was always going to make for success.
Yeah.
And I did. I had the luxury of doing that, which was really awesome. So.
Urban Farmhouse or Myrtle? You have to pick one.
Oh, Urban Farmhouse.
Oh, really? I'm a Myrtle guy.
Yeah, that's a cool,
I was trying to think in my head. I was like, I don't know. I think you'll go Myrtle.
Yeah, that was Myrtle was actually my brainchild. So it was we got to fresh hop season, and we had just kind of experimented around with kettle souring at that time, and so it was really starting to hit the American market, and I was like, what if we did a fresh hop kettle sour? Nobody's around here is doing anything like that, and Meridian hops had just come out, with that, and it just had this real like kind of orange juicy character that was super good. But Urban Farmhouse is one of those, it's an everything beer. It's a Swiss Army knife of beers, you know, so it's so friendly with food that's why I love it. And it's, you know, and it's one of those you can have a fair amount of and still have a good conversation because it's lower in alcohol.
Yeah, yeah. You can have 3 750s in a dinner party and be totally fine.
That's exactly.
And be totally fine. So then Commons ends and you get hooked up with your old boy Sam.
Yeah.
At Von Ebert.
Yeah.
Without like just saying, you know, how was your time at this place? How was your time at this place? That's the next question I want to ask is, what's that relationship like when you spend all that? Did you hire Sam?
Yes.
Yeah, so you hire Sam, and now your guys' careers go different paths, but all of a sudden you come back together.
Yeah. Exactly.
What's it like coming back together with a friend, a coworker, someone that you've grown with?
It was awesome. I mean, Sam's probably one of my favorite people in the industry. I won't say he's my favorite because some people might get, you know, bummed out by that, but I mean, it's just a fact that
he is one of the good guys.
He is literally one of the great guys. I mean, and I think that's part of the thing is at the core, he's just also such a good human being, but we've also grown together, you know, and both of our trajectories in the industry have been very aligned, you know, mm-hmm. and we've been, you know, at the same places for a long time. So yeah, I was actually able to hire Sam at Commons. And then when that shut down, and at the time it was Fatheads when I started working.
Okay. There. You were at Fatheads. Okay.
Yeah. So I was essentially hired.
But this is post Mike. Mike had already left, right?
Mike had already left. Yeah. Yep. Exactly. Mm. And really what I was brought in to do was open the Glendevere location. Mm. And so really to have it kind of be mixed culture and lager focused, mm-hmm. While the Pearl would be more of the hot focus and more production because sure. it's a larger facility. And so, but at the time then the head brewer decided he was wanting to move on. And so literally Sam had just come on board and he was going to work with me out at Glendevere. And then there was a need for a head brewer at the Pearl location. So he and I had to sit down and see, he was like, what do you think? And I said, yeah, you should absolutely
let's do this.
And that's the thing is because if you're going to have a scenario where there's two head brewers, you have to have no ego. You have to have, you know, and if he's the other guy sitting on the other side of the table, I told Tom Cook when he was thinking about hiring Sam, I said, you know, he will make your business better. And it's happened. It's 100% happened.
Yeah, I remember I was working with Sam. He was in Milwaukee working at Breakside for a little bit. And that's where I got to know him. And I'm just like falling in love with this guy. I'm like, wow, this guy's such a cool dude. Yeah. And then I met his wife, Olivia, who was just fantastic as well. And Sam comes to me and he's like, I'm leaving. And I was like, you can't leave. And he's like, well, I'm going to Von Ebert. And I was like, okay. All right, bye, dude.
Sorry about that.
Sorry about that. So here you are, Brewery 2, that you're opening your own, you're opening a spot.
Yeah.
Then you transition into Foreland. What did you, as you walked into Foreland, was it, I'm sure you're going to say a little bit of both, but I'm kind of interested in a little more expansion. Is it learn from your mistakes or start fresh?
I think it's, it's column A, column B.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If you had to lean towards one, did you, like, what's your mind frame? Is it like, don't make the mistakes I made, but I got to go in fresh? Or it's like, let's learn from everything and adapt those into a new way?
I think that's mostly that. But we also started Foreland during the beginning of the pandemic.
Right.
So all the rules were off the table at that point. Like, everything was different. So
nice in a good way?
Some of it.
Yeah.
We didn't have to do events for a while. And
you don't have to go to this random bar in Southeast on a Tuesday.
It's really awesome to talk to, you know, supporters and consumers and stuff, but it's tedious after.
Yeah.
Work, right.
You got to make beer.
Yeah, exactly. But that also meant that the first offerings we had, there was no draft beer out there.
And right.
So the first offerings went into cans and mm-hmm. it's like, this is the first time I've brewed on this system.
We had the cans on this podcast.
Oh, I listened.
Yeah. I felt really terrible.
No. Well, you shouldn't. Yeah. It's a good honest.
I know. I was like, oh my God, I love Sean. Yeah. This is rough.
Yeah.
But I remember, Ben might not be very happy if I say it, but I remember when we opened Slabtown, totally. Ben and Will, like, those are world-class brewers, totally. And those beers we made in the beginning were not awesome.
Absolutely. Yeah. And now imagine you have to put that in a can.
Yeah.
You have to.
You
have to.
You can't just sell it across the bar.
Totally. And it's we've obviously improve because that's mm-hmm. what you do, but it's not easy to go to take what you have as a reputation and then mm-hmm. put it out there again when you, I won't say, you know, it's rough, but you know it's not going to be your finest hour,
right? Yeah.
And so learning from the past was good. I have had a lot of experience within my time in the industry of building breweries. That's what each iteration of the Commons was, building a new brewery, building Glendevere.
One, two, three, now you're at four.
Exactly. And this was a little different since it was an existing brewery before.
It was the allegory spot.
That's
right?
Correct. Yeah, exactly.
Which is a really cool spot. I love McMinnville. I love the little city. I probably wax on about Heater Allen more than any lager brewery on this program. I really love what Rick and Lisa do down there. But I've been fortunate enough to spend a little bit of time in McMinnville because, like, Charlie and David, mm-hmm. like, I knew those guys at Allegory
totally
and stuff. Good. And I'm just so in love with this little beer town in the heart of wine country.
Absolutely.
Because I love wine as well. My wife and I go down there, and it's like, can we sneak down to McMinnville real quick for a couple hours?
Yeah.
Anyway, so please continue.
Well, and I think that's, you know, you hit on something that's really great about it, is that there's something for everybody. And I'm the same boat with you. I love wine, too. So, but going back to the brewery, I think the challenge is really lay in the fact that it was trying to build it up when, you know, the rules of the game are very different. Mm-hmm. But then also, you know, kind of as the world started to open up again, the atmosphere is different. And that's something, you know, towards the future that I've really, really noticed is that the atmosphere is different. It's mm-hmm. not the same as it was 2 years ago.
Right.
Sure, things are going to change, but it's drastically different.
It pushed me out of front of house.
Yeah.
I mean, I had been working for Breakside for almost 5 years. I was in love with the company. They were really good to me.
Yep.
I look back fondly. And one day I, without a job, was just like, I'm out of here.
Yep.
And it was 2 months after we reopened.
That's exactly
it. And I had a job the whole time.
Totally.
They were great to me. And the shift, I'll be honest, the clientele was really rough.
That's what's happened. And mm-hmm. I mean, you're seeing it across service industry in general.
Mm-hmm.
There's a reason why you're getting currently bad service, because barely anybody wants to work in it, because mm-hmm. the money isn't that great for being treated like dirt. You know?
Right.
It's like,
there's no longevity, no career opportunities. No. If you want to move up, you take less money and work more hours.
That's exactly it. Yeah. It's all those things. So I mean, you're seeing that in the beer industry big time.
Yeah, and that's kind of where I want to go. I mean, you've been brewing and, you know, from homebrew to brew school to these three spots for over a decade now.
Yep.
Where are we in the state of the industry? Like, we chatted a little bit about, you know, what the consumer's atmosphere is like. But as far as trends and quality and ingredients, materials, et cetera, all that stuff, I asked Brian this, I ask everybody, what is the state? And let's keep it with us, Northwest beer.
Sure.
Because we're still the mecca, I would say, of America.
Absolutely.
We still have the most consumers. I think right before the pandemic, I think the state of Oregon said craft beer is the fifth largest commerce in the state.
That's
so
right.
It's like, it's strong.
Yeah, it's very, yeah.
In your opinion, where are we?
I think we're on the cusp of a downward cycle. The most eloquent way I can say that.
Sure.
It's the problem that I think, you know, and I'd love to be wrong about this, because, you know, this industry has given me a lot of great friends and contacts and all that kind of stuff. So I want, you know, the success for everybody. But I think post-pandemic, well, again, we're still in the pandemic, but post sort of height of pandemic, beer in the Pacific Northwest is probably going to be a pretty good consolidation. I think you're going to lose a lot of the, like, middle tier breweries.
Really?
I think, and this is just, you know, it's purely my personal beliefs.
And when you say middle tier, do you mean middle tier in terms of quality, barrelage, marketing?
I think all of the above.
Okay.
So I think that quality probably doesn't have a lot to do with it anymore, sadly.
That's what I think too.
But I think it's the people that are very well financially backed are going to ride out the storm because they can afford to.
Right.
The people that have the very small mom and pop shop that have really low overhead and they're one of the only few employees and they service their community and or neighborhood are probably going to be okay for a while longer.
Yeah.
But the problem is that everything has gone up in the industry, price-wise. And so...
And the price of malt just the price of Weyermann malt is up 3 cents a pound.
Every single thing. And the North American barley crop was heavily hit by weather. The 2021 crop was. And so, but, I mean, even down to propane is more expensive. CO2, there's a shortage where it's going.
Gas up, in your van.
Totally. Gasoline in the vehicles.
Yeah.
So every single thing. And at some point, in trickle-down economics, that means that the price of beer goes up, right?
Right.
So at what point do people go, okay, I can just get a cocktail?
Well, right. Yeah, that's what I was just about to mention. Like, I remember this is years ago, we were like, oh, man, the $5 pint is dead.
Yep.
Bro, the $6 pint is dead.
Absolutely.
The $7 pint is getting close to being dead.
It is. So at $12, is that the limit? You know, and I think that's the thing, is that eventually the consumer will say, enough. You know,
yeah.
We can't do this anymore. And so I think that the people that are heavily leveraged in over their heads are going to be the first to lose. But I also think on the supplier front, like I hate to paint all this doom and gloom, but on the supplier front, you know, a lot of them are going to shut down because their costs have all gone up too. And so,
yeah, I wonder if people, do you think Do you think breweries will advert to cutting corners? Do you think quality could go down before we see the amount of breweries go down?
Kind
of like how the big boys, like when you get bigger and bigger and bigger, you know, I use 10 Barrel as an example. I don't love to call people out, but they're big beer, so I don't really care.
Right.
As they rise and grow, that product, that quality starts to diminish. I'm sure all the stuff Whitney's doing in the Pearl and Tanya does and Bend is great. Yeah. I'm talking about the big, big stuff.
Yeah.
Can you see the smaller ones do that same kind of thing just to keep the cost down, right?
I do think so. And one of the things that's driven quality in our region is competition, right? So you had to become, to be viable, you really had to have stand out, really. And when quality was one of the first things to do that.
Yeah.
But if a lot of your competitors are starting to disappear, that's not on the table anymore.
So, right.
So I think, you'll probably see a combination. But I also think that it means that people that are very deeply rooted and can financially withstand it and to put quality as, you know, the high watermark for themselves will just get better too, you know. So I think you're going to kind of simultaneously see both, you know.
So it'll be almost like its own built-in check and balance.
I think so. But, this industry in this region has seen this before, you know. And sort of when I got into it was one of the third wave or whatever. And, you know, we're going to see it again. It's going to just kind of ebb and flow. And
sure.
I mean, there was a quote that was told to me the other day that there are more breweries in the U.S. than there are Burger Kings. So it's
– whoa.
Think about that. So
whoa.
So, yeah, I mean
– whoa. You just hit me real hard
there. Yeah, isn't that crazy to think about? So, I mean – that sadly means there's a lot to go down.
Yeah.
And that's not really fully in our region, but our region is overrun. And I think you're seeing
we are massively saturated.
Totally.
I mean, pre-pandemic, I think it was like 91 breweries in the greater Portland area.
Right.
You know, that includes, you know, like maybe all the way down to Tiger, but that wouldn't count. McMinnville wouldn't count. Hood River probably wouldn't. Maybe you're going to like as far as Washougal, as far as Hillsboro, Tiger, Gresham, 91 plus.
That's a lot.
Yeah. And I'm mostly surprised that, you know, at the height of the pandemic, during lockdown, is usually what I call the height of pandemic. Yep. I expected 20 to 30 breweries to close, and it was only about four or five, and there were ones that already kind of had writing on the wall, Bridgeport, stuff like that.
Right.
We kind of already saw that happening.
Yeah.
I was more surprised at how many people weathered the storm. And I think it's because everyone reached out to their neighbors.
And was like,
if you live in Montevilla, you know, no offense to Culmination or somebody else, but just buy Montevilla or Threshold beer, it's in your neighborhood. Do it to survive.
It's the pivot.
Yeah.
And it's exactly.
Me and my wife drank so much Ecliptic because I was living in North Portland. Ecliptic and Stormbreaker because I was living in North Portland.
Absolutely.
So I guess that's what holds on. So it's no secret by now that you are transitioning out of beer. How much is this some of the biggest factor into your decision?
Big part of it.
Yeah, you just kind of everything going on. How much of the passion have you lost?
I wouldn't say. I think it kind of goes back to that. Like what I really want to be doing in beer is not what I'm doing in beer.
Yeah,
and I it kind of goes back to that. You know. I wish the land of the specialty brewery was still a thing, you know.
Yeah.
It's not to say it doesn't exist. I think there are people out there doing it. I think DeGarde is a really good example.
Yeah. Ale Song's doing just fine.
Ale Song's
Matt's doing
fantastic.
Great.
Yeah. Like there are people that are doing it, but it's not like gangbusters like it used
right.
to be those guys. So like for me, knowing that being a brand new brewery and knowing that, you know, we have to pay the bills, you know. We have to pay our own bills. And so knowing that we had to kind of focus in a little bit of a different area with the idea that those kind of more specialty mixed culture stuff would come a little bit later. And there are some in the works that are going to be released here pretty soon. But that's just all I would rather be doing. If you've been doing it long enough, you get to that point where you're kind of like, no, I just want to do, I want to be the special projects person, you know? And so it kind of hit me one day that I wasn't getting out of it what I've been putting in. And I'm just sort of tired of pushing the boulder up the hill.
Yeah.
And so I don't know, you know, I don't know that it's this mean that I'm fully out quite yet. I would love to be still connected in some way.
But and that's why you mentioned transitioning and not leaving.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that's it. And so, I mean, ultimately, like, I'm trying to to get a little bit more. Photography is a big love of mine. Mm-hmm. So I'm trying to.
I follow you on Instagram.
Yeah, thanks.
Yeah, just to see that stuff. Yeah.
thanks. And I mean, that's really more like outdoor photography and nature photography. But that being said, I think that those skills can translate into, you know, content development and everything. Sure. So that's actually what I'm trying to transition into now and kind of hopefully maybe that's actually going to be the case. But I may have to take a brewing job in the meantime just to pay the
bills. Right.
And that's okay. And that's that thing where it's like I could lay off all of our employees and be that person at our brewery, but
sure.
I don't want to do that.
Yeah, that sounds rough.
I feel very fortunate in the fact that I don't have to, and I'm in a position where I can just sort of step down from that role. So, transitioning out is it's weird. It's bittersweet. You know, it's when you've been doing something 12 years, and it's funny. My last career was 12 years. So
it's just cycles.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like my wife and I have been together for 3.5 years. And before that, the longest relationship I had was 2.5. And right at 2.5, I was like, are you about to leave me?
Yeah.
That's how this goes. And she was like, no, I love you. And I was like, oh my God, it's different.
Breaking the mold.
Yeah, I see what you mean about the specialty stuff. I got a buddy who runs a barrel program at a fairly prominent brewery. And I was asking him, you know, I said, how's the barrel program right now? They do both like dark beers and mixed culture, wild fermentation stuff. And they're all fantastic. And I said, how's it going? He was like, right now, everything tastes amazing, and nobody buys it.
Yep.
It just sits on the shelf.
Yep.
So he's like I had to dump. He was like, I dumped 6 barrels the other day. Beer wasn't great, but it wasn't bad.
Yeah,
but it wasn't exceptional. And if nobody's gonna buy it, then
what's the point? Make room for the exceptional.
Yeah,
which is really sad. and I mean, we've sort of done it to ourselves with like trying to make it super specialty stuff. And that was something I had really hoped that we could do at Foreland, was to really take those beers down a notch. I mean, even with like Saison, as it's not even the fanciest of it.
No.
But it became this thing. Oh, we have to put it in this bottle. We have to do all this stuff.
And bottle condition, live yeast.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And you know, from a quote unquote traditional standpoint, that's all great and very lovely. But if you can still put out a good beer that it doesn't really matter. Like you put it in your shoe and it's still, you know,
right.
That's not, maybe not going to sell that well, but at the same time. So that's what we tried to do is say, no, put it in the same glass that the IPA comes in.
Like
it doesn't need to be in this. It's great to romanticize those kinds of things, but you're also talking about a beer that was traditionally served to farm workers instead of water. You know?
Yeah.
So it's like, where did it get? How did it get so high up on this pedestal?
Yeah, I'm curious because I always thought there was a, you know, and we'll get you out on this one. I'm always curious how the specialty beers couldn't become something like wine.
Yeah,
you know, that there are cheaper versions, there are nicer versions. I always wondered, you know, especially when it comes to maybe mixed fermentation, wild fermentation, or you know, and then the other side, you're like bourbon barrel age stuff. If it's just is one side too acidic and one side is too boozy, and that's why it's not as accessible, or is it just because it's not as high of alcohol, or a sweetness thing, or what? Because I would love my father-in-law always want, you know, we always drink wine at his place, and he has a, you know, $1 million wine cellar thing, and we're always drinking great stuff, and I always want to just be like, oh, by the way, I have this really nice 4-year-old ale song, you know, Goza, barrel-aged Goza.
Yeah,
let's crack this. And everybody's like, nobody wants that.
Yeah, exactly.
And I'm like, how on earth can we make that happen? And it feels like it's a lost cause.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I mean, so much of wine is really about smoke and mirrors anyway.
Yeah.
I mean, that's really what it is.
Yeah.
You're selling a lifestyle, right?
Yeah, so, I don't have – I like to think I have a decent beer palate. I do not have a wine palate.
Yeah.
I know when something's bad, and
exactly.
I know when something's pretty good.
That's it, though. I mean, I've had backstage access to a lot of very high-end wineries. That try this, and I'm like, that's not good. and I have a decent wine palate.
Yeah,
and
okay.
I'm like, I'm so confused, but it's because they put all these different stamps on it that, you know, it needed to be this. And this is not to say that all high-end wine is like that.
Sure.
It's not the case at all. You become a very great winemaker and recognized winemaker by making great wine.
Yeah.
But there's some bad stuff in there too. And whereas, you know, then again, the average American palate is perfectly fine pouring some of it from a box.
Oh, so, yeah, man. Dude, tequila's the same way, dude.
Yeah.
Like, working in restaurants, people are like, I'll have that Patron. And I'm like, I've got this right next to it. That's $5 cheaper a shot, and it's way better. And they're like, no, I'm good.
You're
like, all right.
Because they don't, they've never heard
more for me.
And that's yeah. I love tequila too, so
it's my spirit go-to.
Same, and
I love gin too. And everybody's like, "That's gross," and I'm like, "Okay, you don't have a palate. Exactly. Awesome, I do. Thank you for the compliment."
You and I are very similar. Yeah, and the fact that like I don't always want beer. So, but,
no,
yeah, but it is the case, and that's the thing. It's like even like you know, like I don't know, I can't think of any. There are certain tequilas out there that you're like, this is just over-oaked.
Yeah,
everybody's like, this is the best.
Yeah.
You know? Because it's flavor in your face.
I really love Casamigos Reposado, but it is very strong vanilla.
It is.
Very strong.
It is intense.
And I have enjoyed that. But I can also sit there and say, this is too much.
Yeah, exactly.
Especially at $55 a bottle.
That's the other side of it. Sure. But, I mean, I guess, but if that's what you're looking for, that's one thing. But and again, good and bad is all in the all in the eye of the beholder.
Yep.
But I think that there are, I think that, specialty beer has attempted to do that.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't think it beer's never going to garner the same respect that wine has.
That's true. Wine is drank by the gods.
That's exactly.
Yeah, beer is drank by the blue collar.
That's exactly.
Yeah.
And I think there's room for crossover, and that's something that I had hoped to be able to do by putting a brewery in wine country and really working with the winemakers, because I like doing a lot of those mixed culture beers with wine grapes, because I think, you know, there's an opportunity to create a liquid that, you know, you get to break all the winemaking rules, mm-hmm. and the you know, there are a ton of rules around mixed culture beer production. So really kind of blending techniques and really utilizing this amazing, you know, depth of fruit that you can get and utilizing a wealth of knowledge from all the winemakers. But at the end of the day, you know, you have to have an audience for it.
Right.
It's like, well, I don't want to push the boulder up another hill and then get to the top of that one and be like, oh.
It's easy for us as beer people to say, I really love drinking wine because I can't drink beer all the time. The wine people are like, I love beer because I can't drink wine all the time. Totally. And it's like, well, that's easy for you to say.
Exactly.
it's easy for you to say.
It's the truth.
It's harder for us.
Totally.
All right. You want to stick around for beer of the week?
I would love to.
Okay, cool. And plus, I want to talk to you about a place that is near and dear to my heart. And I think you will have some fun things to talk about.
Awesome.
All right, Sean Burke joining us here. This is Beers on Us with Patrick Harris.
Dive into the start of summer at Whole Foods Market. Check out their Summer Splash event with sales on fresh organic produce, organic strawberries, and a fan favorite sale on Ben & Jerry's and Talenti. Explore deals on grill-friendly meats like organic air-chilled chicken breast, beef and chicken kebabs, all with no antibiotics ever from our meat department. Plus, grab easy sides from prepared foods and cool off with refreshing drinks. Kick off your summer and shop in store or online at Whole Foods Market today.
Beer of the Week time here on Beers on Us with Patrick Harris. We are still joined here by Sean Burke, Commons, Von Ebert, Foreland, as you stretch your wings to leave for potential better, greener pastures.
We'll see about that.
I mean that former literally, if you want to do some wildlife photography.
Yeah, exactly.
How long have you been doing photography stuff?
Oh, gosh. Seriously?
I mean, like thinking about it seriously, not just snapping pictures.
Last couple of years. I would say 2-3 years at this point. Funny story, I actually failed photography in high school.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah, because of my artistic integrity, and I don't want to take the pictures you want me to take.
I want to take what I want to take.
That's not art, you know. But
I need you to make this red ale.
Exactly, and that's precisely it. So, yeah, no, it's been a deep, I mean, I spend so much time out in nature. I'm a native Oregonian, and I'm big into, you know, just a lot of outdoor activities and just being in nature and wilderness, and so. It's a really fun way to kind of capture it and have memories of it, but also a different hobby.
So, sure. Yeah. Sure. I do follow you on Instagram, and I know you love outdoors. You're a fisherman.
Yeah.
You love taking photography. There is not a single spot from Warm Springs to the Columbia that I have not touched.
Mm-hmm.
The Deschutes River is a very, very near and dear thing to my heart. When I was younger, so I grew up in a rafting family, and so we always did stuff in Idaho and Montana and things like that. But then when my family moved to the west, to the real West Coast, the real West Coast, as I call it now, I tried to get into more stuff locally. And so when I was younger, we always like did the mopping thing where you just got drunk and that stuff. But me and my best friend, Ryan, we do a ton of stuff now. We're doing multi-days. My buddy Eddie as well. We do the upper stretch and the lower stretch. What is it about that river that brings you back there the most?
Oh, man. The size of those fish.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's so many things. To tell you the truth, I've got this thing where I'm getting older, and I'm like, I'll catch a couple fish, and I'll be like, I'm going to sit here and have a beer. It's like, watch the osprey. And again, that's where the photography really kind of comes into play. I love the entomology. I love staring at the bugs. And you know, just the fact that you have such a vibrant little stretch of place in such an arid environment, I think is one of the coolest things. And the fact that that whole lower river, too, really, it runs through some beautiful canyon lanes. Mm-hmm. You know, I took a friend out there from the East Coast, and he was like, I didn't know this existed in Oregon. You know, and we were like lower, and, you know, it's real canyon and stuff. Mm-hmm. And it's I don't know. And the fact that you can catch some really awesome fish. Certain times of the year, you can have the place to yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And also White Horse Rapids.
White Horse is great.
Really, really fun. I've helped to pull multiple boats out of that.
You just got to miss that rock right at the front. If you can just do that little dog leg around it.
Gosh, there was one year where we didn't miss it. And we're literally just going, just sitting out of our seats to try to. But luckily, we were in an aluminum boat. We just kind of rolled off.
Oh, okay.
But the
big rubber boats, they're not as forgiving sometimes.
They're really not. But last time we were going down there, there was literally one pinned up against a rock. There's so much current coming up there. So the thing was kind of tacoed. And there was a jet boat up there doing a rescue on it. And we had to assist them, basically, because we were camping in the middle of White Horse Rapids.
Oh, okay.
Anyway, it's a beautiful place. And
when it tells you to stop and scout, you should stop and scout.
That's exactly
right. Yeah.
That's what I love about it.
I think somebody told me that's where the river moves the fastest.
It would make
outside of Shear Falls, obviously.
That would make
the
sense.
I think that's where I'm told it moves the fastest. Even some of that stuff in Maupin, those little spots like Boxcar or Oak Springs, things like that. Yeah, that's where they say it moves the fastest, which makes sense because if you don't, it's not difficult, but it's technical. If you don't hit that right spot, you're in trouble.
Especially in low water. That's, you know, it gets bony in there. And it's a mile long.
Mm-hmm.
There's that. Too.
There's that. Yeah.
Boxcar isn't a mile long.
No, it's like 20 seconds.
Yeah, exactly.
If that. Are you more of an upper guy or a lower guy? What's the better fishing? Just say the opposite so they don't steal your spots.
It's definitely on the crooked. It's actually not. Don't fish the crooked right now. There's no water in it. I like all of it. I mean, to tell you the truth, I'm not like a big fish chaser per se.
So you kind of just choose one based on what you're feeling?
Or wherever I'm at. And so generally the goal is to try to get away from people.
Mm-hmm.
So wherever there are fewer people.
Mm-hmm. And are you in like a drift boat situation or do you just pull over sometimes?
Either or. Yeah, totally. I currently don't have a boat, but did the just selling a boat recently thing, which, you know, they always say the second best day is when you buy it. The first best day of boat ownership is when you sell it. But you know, bank fishing also works just fine. And you can't fish from a boat on that
right,
river anyway.
Right.
So it gets you to
places, maybe better spots.
Like White Horse.
Yeah.
You can't drive to White Horse, but I don't have one over the other. I think there's a lot of elitism in fly fishing and I try to not be a part of that.
Oh man, there's a bunch of elitism in rafting too.
Exactly.
It's no different. You tell a rafter, I've done that mopping stretch like 1,000 times, they're like, cool, loser.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's like, well, I've done more than that. Like, I've been in class 5 rapids in Idaho, you know?
Totally.
My family's done the Grand Canyon.
What do you want?
We're just there to have some fun. I think for me as a rafter, I think the upper is more peaceful.
It is.
I think it's more technical.
It is.
I think it has the better camping spots.
It does, yeah.
I think the lower is prettier.
It is, yeah.
Especially when you get towards the mouth.
That's exactly, yeah. The canyon stretches and stuff. There, I mean, that lower, below max, there's some good rapids.
Mm-hmm.
But, boy, we are not doing a good job talking about this. Dude.
I know, I was going to transition, but I did want to talk to you about the Deschutes because I know it's a big thing for you and it's a big thing for me.
I'm headed out there in a couple of weeks.
I was hoping you were going to say in a couple of hours.
No, I wish that was the case. I think, well, we're starting to get into mushroom hunting season.
Oh, that's what I know. I saw the rain today, and I was just thinking to myself, my buddy, I don't know if you know Todd Burdett up at Sarah Vesa.
Oh, yeah,
Todd. Yeah, he, him and his wife are going camping today.
Nice.
And I was like, oh, it's probably close to mushroom. Oh, but it hasn't rained.
No.
Then I woke up this morning. I was like, huh?
So that's I'm actually going out to the coast starting this weekend over a couple days. And I'm like, the timing should be perfect.
You mostly chanterelles? What are you looking for?
This time of year.
This time of year, yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, we've got a beer in front of us. We should probably talk about this. We did one. I did one with Brian last week. I can't even remember what the beer was.
Good.
But we didn't talk about it at all. I think it was good.
Yeah.
I don't remember. But this is Holy Mountains As Within, So Without, Idaho 7 Extra Pale. You know it's fresh because on the bottom it says Ding Dong, the Queen is Dead. So that's a good thing. It doesn't have a date, but you know it's fresh if it says that. I love finding, first of all, I am a low ABV hop forward drinker till the end of time. My go-to styles are probably a low ABV hop forward beer, a Helles Lager, and a Vienna. That kind of checks all my boxes.
Sure.
And every once in a while, I like a milk stout because I don't know.
Yeah, it's fun. Yeah.
Feel like stoner eating candy.
Yeah, exactly.
So what I love with these is when a brewery, you know, it's not saying it's single hop by any means. I think most people have learned that single hop is not always the best route to go.
Sure.
And consumers are starting to say, like, we don't really want single hop. But I love it when they tell you, like, I'm featuring this hop. What is your experience with Idaho 7 before we, like, really talk about this beer?
Well, the first ever experience I had with it was a Fresh Hop Cool Ship beer. Not Cool Ship. It was a Fooder-aged beer. So very different than most people's first experience with it. I think it's one of those that it really depends on where you get it from. Mm. There are some hops that are so polarizing. Where it's like, you know, you might have you Idaho grown Idaho 7 versus Oregon grown, and so I've had kind of bad versions of this that are pretty sulfury, pretty and not this beer, but I think it's one of those that plays well with others, you know, like you said. I think on its own it's a little, I don't know, it's a little harsh, but I think that it brings in a potential layer that you can work with, like something like Citra or something like that.
Sure. I always said the hop that I have come across as a non-brewer but a consumer with, you know, a decently educated palate, I've always said that, like, Strata was that one. Like, plays well with others.
Totally.
And those have become my favorite hops. And for the longest time, I've had a lot of beers that told me that it has Idaho 7 in it, and I don't know if it was just the combination or what, that I, excuse me, personally have just not enjoyed.
Yeah, same.
So I'm almost, like, chasing that Idaho. Like, Ben Edmonds used to always tell me, there's no hop you don't like.
Yeah.
It's a hop combination you're not into.
That's exactly.
And I try to live with that every day because I was sitting with him and Tyler Brown, and I was like, Tyler, what's your least favorite hop? And he was like, Sabro. Blah, 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 I hate Sabro, which is funny because Tyler's like the nicest guy in the world. So to see him get worked up is pretty funny. And then Ben would just chime in and say, you know, Sabro is very strong, pungent. You just have to know how to use it. And here he's using a lot of Taliesin stuff.
Sure.
Which I dislike for the same reasons as Sabro.
You and me both.
But he always said, you know, don't never hate the hop, hate the combination.
Yep. And that's a really good way of looking at it. I mean, there are certain things, you know, you don't, if you think of it like spicing the soup, you know, there are certain things that just don't work. You know, a bunch of cardamom in your soup might not
be very good.
Be as good as chili powder.
Yeah.
depending on what it is. So, and it's, a lot of it is choice. And again, I think a lot of it has to do with source. Yeah, I found this hop can tend to be pretty catty at times, or like vegetal.
Okay.
The use of that they used it in this is not that. I'm curious what if it is only Idaho 7. Good work.
I know. Why don't they? I always want them to tell me more.
Yeah.
They never want to tell me more. Yeah. Don't they know that I can?
Subterfuge.
Don't they know that you can hand me the recipe to the greatest beer ever made, and I'm still not going to make it as good as you do?
Totally.
You know. I'm curious, since I've got you, the last time I saw you, we were judging at OBA. I think that's the last time I saw you. When you have a beer in this, like, let's take judging out of it. But in this situation where I'm like, hey, taste this beer, what are the parts of the beer, beginning, middle, end, aroma, finish? What are the spots of beer that really talk to you? Like, I'm a finish guy.
Yep.
How the body feels in the mid palate and how it finishes are my two big things.
Yeah.
What are yours?
I'm actually probably pretty similar. I mean, I always start with the nose test.
Sure.
But I also love that transition from smelling to the first taste. But where I really truly get the kind of character of the beer is like that mid palate down to the swallow. Mm. And that was something they taught us in brewing school, was that, you know, in wine world, you know, they spit the wine, but your bitter receptors for your tongue are actually on the back of your tongue.
I know.
So you have to swallow.
I've been at places that are like, oh yeah, you can spit the beer out after you taste it. And I'm like, that I'm not totally, tasting totally. It then.
It's like, and it's like, you know, I'm not always like, oh, I'm trying to get drunk, but
right.
I, you know, there is a, the full process, the whole sensory experience really sure. is looking, you know, from the beginning, from really bringing the aroma in all the way to the end of swallowing. So I tend to be a lot unfinished. So I'm very sensitive to like, oh, that beer's very bitter or you know,
very dry or dry. Too dry. Yeah,
exactly. So not that this one is just.
Yeah. Beer. I don't know if I've ever, I mean, I'm sure I have, but it is hard for me to find a beer that's too dry
yeah.
because I love dry beer.
You and me both yeah. Actually cloying beers get to me after a while with the exception of, you know, if you're drinking an imperial stout, a milk stout, something like
sure.
that, but something that's like multi cloying.
Yeah.
I can't do box that for that reason. Mm. That there are good ones out there, but the vast majority of them are just.
Yeah, dude, I did a Doppelbock table and we were all looking around like,
oh, that's a rough one.
Yeah, like, I don't hate this one.
Yeah.
Let's move it on.
Yeah, that's exactly. Yeah, yeah.
This beer's 5.5%, and although I don't get a ton of alcohol character off of it, boy, the hop character is extremely expressive
yes.
for a pale. I mean, they call it an extra pale, which mm-hmm. usually tells you. It's going to be hoppy and bitter.
Exactly.
Is that, how challenging is it to keep that body low or keep that like full body expression, but the ABV low while still having that pronounced hop? Is it tricky or is it something you, once you find that sweet spot you're in?
Yeah, I think it actually is tricky because I think for a lot of brewers, you know, if you're making just regular West Coast or, you know, kind of American IPA, alcohol has a sweetness to it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know.
That's why I can't do double IPAs.
That's exactly.
They're really hard on me.
Totally, totally. And so, but even sitting at 7%, you know, 6.9 mm-hmm. or something like that, that's going to have a presence that no malt, that malt won't provide, you know, that you're getting purely from the alcohol. So if you start to get into that 5.5, even lower 6, you need something to sort of back that up or make up the difference, right? Otherwise,
yeah.
you're just going to have kind of a thin, lackluster body to the beer.
Sure.
And that's not going to support that high, heavy hop aroma and flavor. So you need something that kind of finishes that off without being cloyingly sweet. So
right, right.
And again, some of that's malt. Some of that is just literally residual sugar, just what you're leaving behind, you know, where it's going to finish.
At the end of the day, it's all just sugar water.
It really is. Yeah, yeah, totally.
how much sugar do you want to leave
totally,
in it?
Totally, totally. Yep. And I mean, if it's Play-Doh, that directly translates to percentage of sugar. So
yep.
That's probably 2.5% sugar.
That's awesome. Well, thank you, my friend, very much for sticking
yeah.
around. This is huge. This podcast is in a real state of transition, and
yeah.
so I'm doing my best to hold on to it and provide good content. And thank you so much for being in today.
Well, thanks for having me. It's been a lot of fun, and I appreciate it.
Yeah, good luck in the future. Those of us in the beer world are probably hoping you have to get a beer job to pay the bills just so you stick around
sure,
a little bit.
Sure, yeah.
but we wish you the best, and maybe I'll see you on the river.
Awesome. Cheers, man.
All right. We'll be back next week. I've got something in the making that I'm just waiting on a text message back, so I don't want to say it yet in case it falls through. So hopefully that comes up next week, and then in 2 weeks we'll have Charlie Devereaux on from Via. I think I'm going to be going down to Via to have that conversation with him. I think he's got 2 new beers to release, so we'll hype those up. So thank you. Please rate, review, subscribe, all that fun stuff. It keeps the podcast going. And we'll be back next week. This is Beers on Us with Patrick Pierce.